It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to a just-released study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, heroin-related deaths have tripled in the years between 2010 and 2013. In Pennsylvania, 47 people died in 2009 as the result of a heroin or opioid overdose. By 2014, that figure had ballooned to more than 800. Overdoses are now the leading cause of death for people 25 to 44 in Pennsylvania. Why is it happening? How did we get here? I'm joined now in studio by acclaimed author Sam Quiñones, whose latest book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He's speaking on the University of Pittsburgh campus at 3:30 this afternoon at the University Club. Sam Quiñones, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Paul.
Also with us is Janine Buchanich. She's a biostatistician at Pitt who has compiled a list of compelling facts and figures about the impact heroin is having on the region. Janine Buchanich, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Before we get to the why of heroin addiction, let's look at what Janine Buchanich has put together. Janine, what can you tell us about the growth of the heroin epidemic in Pennsylvania and nationwide?
Well, as you mentioned, we've seen skyrocketing mortality rates due to overdoses and heroin in particular in western Pennsylvania. And when we say western Pennsylvania, we're not just talking about Allegheny County, but the surrounding counties as well, which actually have the highest death rates. And so we're seeing this out in the suburbs and in the rural areas.
Now, let me just jump in, because that used to not be the case. And all of a sudden, it used to be an urban thing. And you could, as recently as, say, the late 80s, the early 90s, you could be living out in the suburbs or in rural parts of the state outside of the big cities like Pittsburgh and be removed from all of this. That's not the case anymore. Do we know why that is?
Well, I think that part of why that is described in Sam's book very well about the heroin traffickers, and Sam can do this much better than I, but the heroin traffickers going out and looking for communities like that were easy for them to get into and use their tactics for selling heroin.
But the numbers are ballooning in the suburbs. What are some of the other stats you can share with us?
So the rates among, in Pennsylvania, the rates among women are the highest. 25 to 34-year-old women are the most affected. Westmoreland County has the highest death rates in this area. Cambria County has the highest death rates for young men. So you're really talking about areas outside of the city. 65% of the people who are dying from these overdoses are men. 35% are women. They are almost all white. And the age ranges from as young as in their teens all the way up to in their 60s and 70s.
There's a lot of information there. How do you go about tracking this and then putting it all together?
So part of what the CDC does is track these data. The University of Pittsburgh also has a system called the Mortality and Population Data System, where we track these data. And so we use the death information that we have to analyze statistics and look at these types of trends.
So, Sam Quiñones, why is this happening? What's going on?
Well, this story is actually a very old story. It goes back about 20 years, really. And it goes back to a revolution in legitimate U.S. medicine. It doesn't have really to do with heroin. Heroin comes after. This is a story that really begins not with drug traffickers. It's the first one since the modern post-World War II America where the problem really is not due to street gangs or drug traffickers on the street, what have you. It's really due to legitimate U.S. medicine. And there was a revolution in thinking beginning in the late 80s, but really gaining steam in the 1990s, that we were a country in pain. There was an epidemic of pain all across this country that we were not treating, that we had ignored. And what's more, we had the tools to treat it. There were certain pain crusaders, doctors, specialists in this, who really believed that we needed to liberalize very aggressively the prescribing of pain pills, opiates for all kinds of pain. And they made this case very persuasively. They were helped in all this, of course, by pharmaceutical companies that were making these pain pills, who gave them money and gave them kind of a megaphone in a variety of ways, sponsored them in seminars and whatnot. And through the 1990s, a new conventional wisdom emerged in the United States. The previous one was never use these pills for any reason. That was also crazy. People would be dying in horrible agony from cancer, 3 months to live, and you still wouldn't prescribe them these pills that would allow them these drugs that would allow them to live the last 3 months with pain free. That was crazy. That's what kind of the crucible that formed and shaped these pain specialists.
This was a backlash to the conservative approach of the way pain medications had been administered.
Of never prescribing them ever for almost, you know, each time you did, you need three doctor's signatures and this kind of, that was also crazy. What had ended up happening, though, was that this pendulum began to swing and didn't stop, and it kept on going past terminal pain patients to all manner of pain, and suddenly these pills were being used for post-surgery when you would get your appendix out, when you would get your wisdom teeth out. You know, all of a sudden there was this idea that we were a country that could not really bear or could not tolerate any pain. There were new ideas that helped this idea along. The pain was now the fifth vital sign, similar to your pulse. Of course, it's not a vital sign at all, because you cannot measure it the same way every day. It's highly subjective. You'll feel pain one way, I'll feel it a completely different way. What ended up happening, though, through this pain revolution that really begins in the 80s and takes off really in the 1990s, is that a new conventional wisdom convinces doctors that they can prescribe these pills with virtually no risk of addiction to people who are suffering from pain. They were very concerned about the addiction issue and the risk that involved in all this. These specialists and the pharmaceutical companies convinced them that these drugs were, the buzzword was, virtually non-addictive, or less than 1% of all pain patients get addicted.
How did they arrive at that conclusion?
Well, there's a long story that goes along with that I talk about in my book, using a variety of specious kind of and spurious, really, they called them studies. They were not studies. They were just kind of, I don't even think they were reports. In one case, it was they used one letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine back in 1980 as proof. Look, this is what people are saying now, that these pills are not addictive. We know this now. 3,000 years of experience with opium-based painkillers, human beings know that they have remarkable painkilling properties, blessed, merciful painkilling properties, and they are utterly addictive and can turn anybody into a slave to them. That second half was ignored, and the first half was focused on, and more doctors were finding, Americans too were changing. Americans wanted their pain dealt with immediately. We didn't have we didn't apply the same accountability that we applied to everywhere else to ourselves. When a doctor says, you need to run more, you need to stop drinking sodas, you need to lose weight, do yoga, do a variety of things, we didn't go along with that. We wanted our pain fixed, and pills, in the short term anyway, fixed them.
And so I guess there's a couple questions here. Why all of a sudden, you know, why were Americans becoming completely intolerant of, when it came to dealing with pain, pain that was, if not tolerated, was endured in the past as part of the healing process?
That's a terrific question. I mean, you get into issues when you talk about this topic, get far beyond drugs, into questions of the effect of prosperity. Do we have too much prosperity? Are we too bathed in luxury to actually, you know, deal with tough times?
Has our attention span become so short, and our instant gratification society
precisely
enabled us to therefore demand that we get our painkillers, and we're not going to deal with the pain at all?
You know, I'm a crime reporter at heart. I'm not much of a philosopher, but this story kind of turned me into a philosopher. You think about the morphine molecule that's in all these drugs. All these drugs are similar. Heroin, oxycodone, hydrocodone, they all are opiate derivatives. And they all contain the morphine molecule, which is got, it's an unseen particle, yet it has heaven and hell in the same particle. It's like, it's got, as I said, blessed pain relief and utter, the ability to turn everybody into a slave.
And not to oversimplify, you know, the role of the medical society and the medical the pain and drug makers and manufacturers, but they're exacerbating the problem because there's a buck to be made, and presumably the doctors are getting out in front and being the spokespeople because they're getting paid off too.
Well, but also, no, I think some of these pain specialists really believe this. This was not a kind of a cynical thing on the
part
of these.
They believe they found a wonder drug and that it was not,
and that they were relieving the pain that they had seen so many people suffer from for years when they were young residents and young internists and in the first parts of their career.
But how could they believe that it wouldn't be addictive?
They convinced themselves. That's the way the
why
it's when you want to believe something, human beings have an enormous capacity to believe almost anything if you want to believe it. And that's pretty much what happened. That's also what happened with doctors. Doctors said, I've got all these pain patients, all these people demanding that I fix them. I don't have any tools. Insurance companies, by the way, at this time were cutting back on the kinds of things that they would reimburse for. So the doctor, in the middle of what was determined to be a pain epidemic, had one tool, and that was these pills. Now, these pills became the precursor to, or the gateway, really, to all this heroin addiction that we are seeing now. And it's very rare, I believe, nowadays to find any heroin addict who did not start in some way with these pain pills.
And I want to get into discussing how we got from A to B there, how we got from legal prescribed pain medications like OxyContin to people becoming addicted to heroin. We are talking about the alarming rate at which heroin deaths and addiction has increased in recent years in Pennsylvania and throughout the United States with acclaimed author Sam Quinones, whose latest book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Also with us is Janine Buchanich. She's a biostatistician at Pitt who has compiled a list of facts and figures about the impact heroin is having on the region. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. If you have gone through a lot of what we're describing here in terms of becoming addicted to painkillers, perhaps it led you to heroin, perhaps not, perhaps you know someone. And Janine, I'm guessing you have statistics on this. So we're getting to the point where just about all of us know someone, if not someone in our family, someone who is addicted to heroin, who's gone through the dangers of this drug or sadly succumbed to the dangers of it. 412-246-2002 is the number to call to share your story with us. And Janine, I just want to get back to you before we kind of connect the dots some more here with Sam about just the rate at which so many more families that have had to deal with this problem. And, you know, in the 50s, say, or 60s, if you weren't, not to stereotype, but if you weren't a musician, probably a jazz musician, or, you know, someone who dwelled in the streets, this problem did not touch your life. But now it is. And you've got numbers that explain just how dramatic the increase is.
Right. And so we say that there are 300 deaths in Allegheny County last year, but there are probably 10 times more addicts who have not died from their overdose. There are estimates that there are 40,000 heroin addicts in Pennsylvania right now. And from what we can see, the death rate increased 20% between 2013 and 2014, and it's expected to increase again in 2015. So we have not reached a peak here in Western Pennsylvania. From what we can see, we're not even close. So it's still blossoming and spreading in this area remarkably fast.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Let's go to Nick from Emsworth. Nick, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I fell 35 feet 14 years ago. So I was on OxyContin and Percocet, primarily Percocet, but you know, I look at drugs as something, a necessary evil. So I've always been careful, and I've actually tapered myself off. You know, I have a month's supply, maybe would spread to 2 or 3 months, and I only take it when I really need it. So I don't want them to shut it off for people like me who responsibly use, you know, pain medication, and I've never been drunk. I mean, I drink on occasion, very seldom, but I've never been drunk. So, you know, I want people to know there are people like me who really need this on occasion and not to be, you know, shut off from something like that.
And Nick, before, you know, I let our guests respond, how have you been able to stay responsible? What is it that you've done to avoid falling into the pitfalls that others have?
Well, I don't look at it as a, you know, it's just a mental attitude that I have towards any kind of drug or pain medication or anything. I just, like, you know, I see it. My father was an alcoholic, and I saw that alcoholism did not help him. So I keep away from alcohol because it depresses me. So my brother has a tendency to drink and get depressed. So I look, you know, I look at it in that way.
It may come down to whether you have an addictive personality or not. But
right.
good for you, Nick. And I'll let Sam respond. You know, what about people like Nick who say,
right,
look, not everybody's abusing this stuff.
No,
and don't shut us off.
That's certainly true. And that's how it behooves people like Nick to begin to be vocal, but also vocal in the way that these drugs are being prescribed, because these drugs have been prescribed like a fire hose for a good 20 years now. And the more that's the case, the more the reaction is possible to say, we got to just shut the whole fire hose off. Really, these drugs need to be judiciously prescribed. No one is saying they should never be prescribed. Everybody understands their use. The problem is when you use the fire hose approach, which we've used since the mid-1990s, for all kinds of, then pretty soon you will get what we have today, which is widespread addiction. I congratulate Nick, but I think a lot of people out there began the same way and got addicted, and for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they do have an addictive personality. Sometimes they don't. There's a variety of reasons why they would. But I think frequently I hear people say, "Yeah, I need these pills," and I believe them. I believe that they do. That's what behooves them to start talking to people about not just allowing the status quo up to now to exist, but to really push doctors to be very judicious about how they prescribe these things. They have to be constituents in this as well. They have to have their voice heard. And just to say, no, I want my pills, and the collateral damage to this fire hose approach has been catastrophic, and not just here in Pittsburgh, not just here in Western Pennsylvania. I've been all over this country, from Charlotte to Portland, and I can tell you that everywhere in the country, people are dying, families are being torn asunder by horrible years-long addiction, and this is something that this massive prescribing of pills has caused. And for people who really do need them, like Nick, I think they need to start being heard, but they need to come at it to say they understand that there's a massive collateral damage that goes along with this, and that they want that to stop as well.
How does and that certainly explains what Janine was talking about earlier about this proliferation of heroin addiction in the suburbs and in rural areas in places where we didn't see it before. But before we take some more calls here, let's get to the question of, how do we get from people who are using OxyContin, how do they go from using that to becoming heroin addicts?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of things. First of all, there's two drugs involved in most of these pills. It's either hydrocodone or oxycodone, and they are synthetic opiates that are very, very molecularly very similar to heroin. They have the same euphoria, create the same euphoria, have the same effect on the brain chemistry, and create the same withdrawals, very similar to heroin, right? Now, what ends up happening is that people use these for a while, and their tolerance grows. Crucial in all this, in this story of transformation from transition from pills to heroin, was OxyContin. Before OxyContin, there was no bridge to heroin. OxyContin, the other pills had a little bit of hydrocodone and some acetaminophen, and if you used a lot of it, it would damage your liver. Some people made that switch to heroin, but it was really not very common, really. What ends up happening is when OxyContin comes out, it's a game changer. It provides the bridge. So you start out on Vicodin or Percocet. Then your tolerance grows. You before would stop there because you didn't want to go to heroin. No one really wants to go to heroin. But there was no bridge there. Now OxyContin comes along. It's got no acetaminophen in it that is kind of acts as a deterrent to abuse. And so it's just a full whack of 40 milligrams or 80 milligrams of oxycodone. People get into that, and that's a whole other level of addiction, both in terms of the amount of dope hitting your brain and also the amount of money that you're going to need to satisfy your addiction every day. All of a sudden, it's $100, $150, $200 a day because these pills, after you have to buy them on the street, or a dollar a milligram. We now have almost all of our heroin comes from Colombia or from Mexico. It's no longer coming in the French Connection days from Turkey or Afghanistan or the Middle East or somewhere. That means the price for heroin is cheaper than it's ever been because it has to go a shorter distance to get here now. So all of a sudden, heroin is a fifth to a tenth, depending on where you are, of the price of the pills on the street. And you've got a lot of people who are making that, who have made that transition to OxyContin. They now have addictions that are $100+ a day. They can't afford it. They make that switch. Plus, frequently, or at times anyway, I've known a lot of people who have begun, once the snorting or just taking the pill and then snorting it after a while doesn't work, they turn to shooting it. Once you've shot something into your vein, you cross that Rubicon of the stigma of the needle, and then heroin is a very easy thing to transition to after that as well. That transition has been taking place for a number of years, but it's not the numbers of people, as Jinyoung was saying, have really the numbers of people doing that, making that transition, have been really accelerating in the last two or three or four.
And there's also the cheaper version known as black tar heroin,
right,
which we'll get to. Explaining what that is, and also lots of folks lined up on the phone lines that want to get in on the conversation. So we need to take a break, but we are talking about the proliferation of heroin use, heroin addiction, and heroin deaths in Western Pennsylvania. And our guests are author Sam Quinones, whose latest book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Also with us, Janine Buchanich, biostatistician at Pitt, who has compiled a list of facts and figures, which she has already begun sharing with us about the impact heroin is having on the region. We'll continue our discussion. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the heroin epidemic in Pennsylvania and really what is a nationwide problem with acclaimed author Sam Quinones, whose book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, addresses this topic. And also with us is Janine Buchanich, a biostatistician at Pitt. By the way, Sam Quinones is speaking at the University of Pittsburgh on the campus today at 3:30 at the University Club if you want to hear more from him. In the meantime, there are callers who want to engage our guests at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Let's start with Bob in Scott Township. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Okay. I want to thank you for bringing out this information because it was rather timely. I was talking with my neighbor last night, and she recently attended a forum on the exact topic you're covering here, and they were pushing out the old adage that people who smoke marijuana, using it as a gateway drug, that end up being heroin addicts is the main reason why we have such an increase in overdose deaths. And I said, I think that was dispensed a long time ago, and I think that your research and the fact that most of these are starting out now with pills is a great help to in a public service, and I want to thank you for it.
Thank you. I would say, though, here's a caveat to that it's true that Virtually every heroin addict who gets addicted in the last 10, 15 years has gone through pills. Many times, though, those folks have started smoking heroin. I'm sorry, marijuana. What has happened with marijuana is a whole other topic for a show, but it's become enormously, enormously potent, largely because it's illegal, and you got these guys kind of monkeying around with hybrid versions of it. And so now, marijuana is no longer the marijuana of my. I'm 56 in the 70s. It was a quite. It was like a beer kind of. Now
unless
marijuana.
Unless there was PCP
like,
in it.
Yes, and or it feels more like LSD today. But the caller Bob's correct that. Virtually everybody, I have not yet heard a story, let me put it this way, of an addict who ended up on heroin who did not start with the pills. And that is the great gateway today. And again, as I say, this is the first time in the history of modern America where this has started with legitimate medicine and not, you know, street traffickers.
Bob, thank you for that call. Let's go to Zeb. As what it says here on the screen, Zeb from Pittsburgh. Hope I got that right. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's with a V. It's Zev.
Zev. I beg your pardon. Zev, welcome.
It's okay. My name is Zev Gottinger. I'm a cultural anthropologist, and I had a question about earlier when the host was asking the author about why it's happening. I immediately thought about the importance of ideology. And the author said that you can believe anything you want if you believe it enough.
You can convince yourself of anything, is what Sam said, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, the influence of ideology on the structure, and that thought about the not Americans not being able to feel pain, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it, but just ideology in general, you know, the legitimization of behavior by power structures, how has that gone into it? And maybe,
Zev, I'm going to let you go here because I have no idea really where you're going with this, and... you know, good luck. Take care of yourself. I don't know what to add to that other than I guess maybe he was questioning.
Well, I would say that there are powerful forces that have pushed this idea that we Americans cannot really handle pain and we really ought to just rely on pills to deal with whatever pain we are feeling. I think it's a sad thing. I think it's part of our own prosperity that we have achieved in the last 20, 25 years of that we simply are kind of incapable now of getting our minds around the idea that we should feel any pain. We're like the entitlement idea or we're Americans, so therefore we're entitled to a life free of pain.
Let's go to Lisa from Pittsburgh. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to commend your guests for talking about, especially when he's talking about the entitlement and the prosperity. It's really an issue within our society that we don't want to feel pain. Very quickly, about a year ago, I had a bad infection in my mouth, went to the dentist. He gave me, I don't know, Percocet or Vicodin. I loved it. I never felt a more beautiful state of existence in my life when I took the pain medication. And I felt like I was levitating. It was beautiful, and it took away that pain. I took it for a day and a half, and I threw those pills away because I knew how bad, how good that felt and how my body would crave it. So I threw it away, and this just goes back to that your guest is talking about. We have an intolerance for pain. We don't want any pain. We're entitled. Why should we deal with pain? And it's all over our commercials and everything. But that moment woke me up to say, you could very, very easily love this thing and become addicted to it. By the grace of God, I didn't. So I just wanted to commend your guests for talking about that. So important.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Lisa. And Sam, I'm going to guess that Lisa is an exception to the rule in terms of how she was able to just throw the stuff away.
I'm not sure if she is. I mean, I think a lot of people take these and have a very wary feeling about what am I doing with these? I mean, particularly nowadays, I think a lot of folks kind of go, well, I don't really know. I myself even before I got into this project, I really, as I said, I'm a crime reporter. I didn't know anything about Vicodin or OxyContin before I got into this. I had a doctor prescribe me 60 Vicodin to take home with me after I got my appendix out. And I don't like taking pills. I think that they are crutch, and I don't like that. And so it was, I think this is an attitude that a lot of Americans still hold. I think we've been taught we should fear pain, but truth is a lot of us are still kind of hardy folks, and we want to avoid that. But again, the mere fact that somebody prescribed me a bottle of 60 Vicodin to take home with me, which was unthinkable 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Is the message in that bottle was, go ahead, because they're non-addictive. These won't addict you. This, don't worry about it. In my case, I threw them away. I used two and threw them away.
So you can really relate to what Lisa's saying. You did the same thing.
I didn't feel the euphoria that she felt. I think I took one or two. It's been a while now.
But you threw them away.
What happened was I kept them in my medicine cabinet for a long time because I paid for them. I don't like to throw. But then I got into this project. I had 60 Vicodin in my house. I realized what I had, and I realized those kinds of bottles are frequently diverted, as they say, or people mess with them, come into my house, and you know, a friend will look through my medicine cabinet and take the pills. I didn't want those pills entering the black market, basically, and so I threw them away.
We do a lot of that, though, don't we? We hang on to that because that pain, you know, we've all dealt with pain of one kind or another, and you sort of want to keep those, even though the doctor said, okay, stop taking them. You're going to keep them in your medicine cabinet for who knows how long, just in case.
Just in case, and that's what's happened. We have the rising, what I call a rising sea level of pills across the country, and a lot of them are in our medicine cabinet. And this, so it's the supply has been the problem. We always talk about drug problems. Are they demand driven or supply driven? In this case, frankly, the supply, excess supply, is what drove it.
Let's go to John in Pittsburgh. Hi, John. You're on with Sam Canonias and Janine Bukanich.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us.
I just want to start off a little bit how I got started. I never really had a serious injury or ailment that required me to take any pain medication. But about 5 years ago at school, I was introduced to OxyContin. That was the first time I had ever taken a strong opiate. And I'll tell you what, I fell in love instantly. Like the panel said, there is no Tylenol. There's no nothing to, make you feel sick. It's just strictly oxycodone. And I just fell in love. And my progression happened extremely quickly. I went from having, a nice apartment in place to just almost living on the streets. I had no possessions. I had sold them all.
You became an addict. You became an addict, John?
To, being able to introduce the heroin. Instead of spending $250 a day and being broke, I can spend a fourth of that and get twice as high. And I don't want to put any, blame on a manufacturer, but Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin, released a statement saying that they've done tests that there's less than 1% of an addiction rate with OxyContin, which we can all say is extremely false.
It's nonsense.
And, I am a recovering heroin addict today. I go to meetings every single day of my life because I have to, because I know out there, especially in Washington County today, people are dying every day. And it's because, these dealers are mixing heroin with all kinds of things like fentanyl, which is 100 times more powerful than morphine, and that's why people are dying, because unlike a little pill, exactly how much of a milligram of, a painkiller you're getting, as opposed to a bag of just a powder. It can be mixed with anything. And that's, people try to, do the same amount all the time, but you never know what you're going to get in that bag. And that's why it's killing people. And I've overdosed before and been needed to, have Narcan, and by the grace of God, I'm alive today, and trying to do my service work to help other addicts. But I just wanted to share, my progression and where I'm at today. And it's
well,
not
John,
like in the past where you had to go to a destitute neighborhood to find it. It's everywhere. It's in every neighborhood, and it's not hard to find.
Well, John, what you're saying is very important for our listeners to hear, and I appreciate you're having the courage and taking the time to call us and share your story with us. And, if Sam was nodding because he recognizes and understands a lot of what you're saying, I just hope that you stay on the path that you're on as a recovering heroin addict and that you're able to salvage your life and pull yourself together. It sounds like you have, so good for you. That was John from Pittsburgh, and Sam, you were nodding through a lot of that.
Basically, I mean, I think his story is the story repeated, I would say, probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times across America in the last 15 years or so, where people start out. And again, he got introduced. What he meant was there was so many pills in his high school available in people's medicine cabinets that once somebody got some out of the medicine cabinets and introduced it to this, and that's how he didn't have an injury, but that's this is another common way people get introduced means there's this massive supply circulating out there, and you just kind of, you know, you never introduced to these pills in 1980s. It just didn't really happen. You had to be part of this kind of drug underworld. Now you trip over it, you know, in suburban high schools.
And I wanted to jump in here people who may be thinking, oh, I do have an old prescription that I've held on to. There are some local police stations in the area that have ongoing drug take back programs. I know of one in the Indiana Township Police Department that you can go and give them your prescriptions if you're concerned about throwing them away or flushing them down the toilet. There are police stations that will take them 24 hours a day, and so you don't have to worry about someone looking in your medicine cabinet or even your own child getting hold of an old prescription.
And when you said, I think it was Janine, you said that this is not just a problem in Allegheny County. You heard John there mentioning Washington County, so another area south of Pittsburgh that where you might not have seen this happening 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now it is.
Right. In August of this year, you know, more than 20 people overdosed in a 2 or 3 day period in Washington County, three of whom died on heroin that they found out later that had been mixed with fentanyl. So it is a huge problem outside of the Pittsburgh area, for sure.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guests are Janine Bukanic, who is a biostatistician at Pitt, also author Sam Quinones, author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam, I had a while back, and we're running out of time here, but I wanted to, you know, kind of make this connection for people. Which you do in your book, how the stories of the growth of pain growth of pain medications like OxyContin, and the enormous profits of trafficking black tar heroin,
right,
the cheapest form of the drug, fit together.
Yes, black tar heroin is a form of heroin. It's heroin. It's just semi-processed. It's not been processed down to the number of steps, chemical steps needed to get to kind of the white powder heroin. It looks like Tootsie Roll. It's very sticky, and it has a lot of impurities in it and will clog your veins, and it has an added public health problem of clogging veins, creating infections and that kind of stuff. But it's very, very cheap. One reason why heroin is...
Where does it come from?
Mexico. In this hemisphere, it's all made in Mexico. And the story I tell in the book is about one town in Mexico where everybody in the town has perfected a method of selling black tar heroin retail, very much like pizza, which means that you have dispatchers, operators standing by, and addicts call a number, and the dispatchers dispatch. Usually there's a team of guys working together, 3-4 guys, the dispatcher plus 2-3 drivers. He dispatches a driver who has usually 20 to 30 balloons of 1/10 of a gram heroin balloons in his mouth with a big jug of water next to him. In case he gets pulled over, he swigs down the balloons. The balloons go into his bowels, and the cop who pulls him over is none the wiser, presumably. But these guys, these drivers, tool around the area selling, fulfilling orders. And so you call up just like you'd order pizza and say, I need 5 hits and I'm going to be here. And they will deliver. And it's part of their method is they are nonviolent. There's no guns involved. There's no shootouts for territory. They compete with each other, but because they're all from the same town, they're not going to kill each other. They'll create problems back home. So they are competing with each other. They drop the price through competition. And so now you get heroin that's really about the cheapest it's ever been in the history of the United States. These guys delivering all over, and wherever they go, they tend to saturate. So Columbus, for example, I believe at any given time, there's 6 to 8 to 10 crews of these guys from this one town, the town of Jalisco in the state of Nayarit, Mexico, where they have developed this system, and they have taken it as if it were a franchise, like the Domino's pizza of heroin, from Los Angeles over the last 20, 25 years across the country to this area, to Charlotte, to Columbus.
So part of the proliferation of this is the fact that there's a lot of money to be made, and these are guys who are, yeah, you know, seeing gold, pots of gold at the end of the rainbow. David in an email says the late 80s and 90s also coincided with making children a part of the prescription markets, prescribing en masse Adderall, Ritalin, etc., to combat hide, as well as I think that's what he's saying there. As well as other ailments. If you trace this back, you will find that most of this age group now fits within the 25 to 30 range, and it's a problem with overprescription in general. He's talking about to combat ADD and ADHD.
Yeah, I would say that is right on the mark. Right. I don't know if you have anything to say on that, Janine. But.
Well, that is the age group where we're seeing very high rates of overdose right now, and it's actually in western Pennsylvania, the age group with the highest rates that have increased most rapidly in 25 to 34-year-olds. So that time period certainly does fit with what we're seeing now.
And I can say that anecdotally, I have no studies. I would love for someone to do a study on the number of heroin addicts who were first prescribed Adderall for ADHD and all these kinds of things. But my feeling is that there is a very strong anecdotal connection.
I want to apologize to the people we have holding. We simply, at this point, do not have time for your calls. Before we wrap this up, though, the one question I think that needs to be asked is, has America done enough to combat this?
Here's the thing. This is the question is, has the private sector done enough to combat this? This is a private sector created problem. The profits have all gone to the private sector. The public sector is left with the costs, the jails, coroners, public health nurses, ER docs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The big question is, what has pharmaceutical companies and what have doctors done to put a damper on this? This is, I believe, being a cop today trying to fight heroin is like standing in the ocean trying to fight back the tide. To me, I feel we have not asked enough of the private sector to step up, because they've made all the profits on this. OxyContin, they've sold $35 billion worth of OxyContin since the drug was released. The family that owns Purdue Pharma is now one of Forbes' wealthiest American families. There seems to me to be an ample opportunity here to ask the private sector, or force the private sector, to step up and doing more about this.
I wish we had more time, but we need to get to another guest on this program who deals with this problem. But in the meantime, I want to thank our guest today, author Sam Quinones, whose book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He's speaking on the Pitt campus at the University Club today at 3:30. Also, Janine Buchanich, a biostatistician at Pitt. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with a drug and addiction counselor about how she treats people for addiction. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.